ghost stories are just variants of the same story. Good beats evil, cowboys and Indians, profits and loss. This story has been told 1,000,000,000 times, and the ubiquity of it is what I would call a great tragedy. A tragedy because of the consequences it has on our imagination and our relationships. The Brilliant Podcast is an attempt to tell different kinds of stories, ones with complex moral plays, ones that aren't so clearly stories, and ones that are of human size. Our motivation to tell these takes a desire to see a proliferation of different stories and not just the simple morality plays of popular culture or the inverted, but otherwise identical, stories of the radical milieu. We believe that a world of free people is possible. We call these people, the people who are in an active pursuit of a free world, the brilliant, because they are impossible to ignore and yet cannot be seen directly, especially in a world that is dull and gray. I am your host, Bellamy, joined by your co-host, Aragorn, and in the background, our sound engineer is Roy Burton.
And one day I came in, a woman who had lost a child was talking to a robot in the shape of a baby seal. It seemed to be looking in her eyes. It seemed to be following the conversation. It comforted her. And many people found this amazing.
So I'm going to talk to you about you and how you can be brilliant every single day.
Welcome to the fourth episode of the Brilliant Podcast. This week, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to sort of de-emphasize the news stories, but we're going to talk a little bit about the Haters Podcast, which we're going to type a dialogue with. We're going to talk a little bit about Free Radical Radio. And finally, I'm going to tell, quote-unquote, my side of the story of the recent Bob Black controversy, which I also just finished a blog post about at my blog, aragorn.anarchyplanet.org. But the theme for this week, and the topic that we'll be talking about mostly, is critical theory, or criticism, or critique. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the anarchist understanding of these terms are, and we're going to use some articles from an article from Wolfie Landstreicher called Critical Thinking as an Anarchist Weapon, an article or two from Jason McQuinn on Post-Left Anarchy, and a piece from a journal that we published last year called Attentat, called The Critique of Critique.
And it's also now the end of our sort of four-episode arc of trial period experimentation of doing this with basically no listeners and no listener feedback. So now that you've maybe listened to all of these, we'd love to hear what you think. And I'm assuming there's going to be some sort of email situation, which is not yet sorted.
Actually, you can email thebrilliant at thebrilliant.org.
Okay, it is sorted. I'm kept in the dark about these things.
And all permutations of that email address should work. Okay, this is the news from the Brilliant section. And this week, as far as I was concerned, there didn't seem to be a lot of exciting news, a lot of things that I wanted to talk about. So mostly what we're going to talk about this time around are things that Bellamy was interested in.
Sure. So part of doing media for me is to be in dialogue with other forms of media.
Suspicious.
Which is also something that Aragorn has said is the purpose of doing regular media. And so I did want to talk just for a bit about the Haters Podcast. I waded into the A-News fray and volleyed some questions their way, and they were answered. There was a short exchange, and then I stopped engaging with it, so this is me continuing to engage with it. So the structure of this podcast is that they go to mainstream big-budget films, at least so far. I don't know if there's seems to be some talk of maybe doing different things, but and they make predictions about the movies, which are pessimistic, hostile predictions, and then they review the movie afterward, and clearly it's also has this sort of fun, humorous bend, even though it's also it seems to be a serious engagement. And so something I did want to talk about was just the idea of critiquing spectacular culture, critiquing the spectacle. And when I was in my late teens and early 20s and was newly radicalized and wasn't sure what to do with all these ideas, I became very enamored of this notion that I needed to watch what sort of the people were watching, mm-hmm. right? Watch the mainstream things and analyze them. And I had this idea that I could then better be equipped to talk to people about things if I knew how they were being programmed to be these misogynist, racist, terrible, submissive, wage slave people. Mm-hmm. But now, well, I do still think this, I don't want to say this kind of critique is not useful or shouldn't be done, because I don't really want to tell anyone that. I want them to engage with the things they want to engage with. I do feel more that this kind of critique is oddly circular or self-justifying or mm-hmm. self-perpetuating, because it becomes increasingly relevant to oneself the more they consume the media, but their practice of developing the critique necessitates that they consume the media. And so there seems to be this kind of hamster wheel thing going on. And I wonder about that. I don't know if you have a response to that. I have other things to say about this too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm basically totally disinterested in their podcast because I almost entirely watch mainstream Drek for if I'm going to go to a movie theater. And that's basically based on the assumption that if I'm going to spend $8 to be entertained for 2 hours, I better be fucking entertained for 2 hours. And so I don't go to watch a serious drama. Like I was tempted to go see the new Johnny Depp movie that's about mobs and whatnot. And so that'll probably be a fine movie, but I absolutely don't need to spend $8 to see that movie. I'm going to download it later. Mm-hmm. It's going to play in my second screen while I'm doing something else. And so I'm basically consuming media in a way that's totally offensive to the very sort of firmament of what they're trying to do with their project. Mm-hmm. I don't see media as being, especially popular, mainstream, cinematic media. I totally agree with DeBoer's assessment that the eyes are the easiest thing to deceive. And so, yeah, again, if I'm just going to be entertained, I want to be deceived for 2 hours. And if it's got to be a dancing robot, it's got to involve some laser beams, and probably the good guys are going to win at the end.
Yeah, and I guess my, as I told to one of the creators, for me, part of it, it's totally irrelevant to me because I basically don't consume that kind of media at all. Mm-hmm. I have other commodity vices or whatever you want to call
it. That we've established that you're pure and I'm
no, I'm not pure. A filthy cretin. So I'm not pure. I consume intoxicants in order to survive in this world, but not with my eyes, with my mouth. So it that's part of why I say that it's this self-perpetuating thing, because to me, like, now that I'm no longer interested in, you know, having this understanding of what's going on in popular culture as part of my anarchist practice, it becomes totally irrelevant to me because I'm just not consuming it. But then the other thing I wanted to touch on was their self-introduction part of it. They say, everybody hates capitalism, and capitalism is everywhere, especially in our culture, which is kind of odd. If it's everywhere, then how is it especially in one place or another? Indeed, it is largely through culture that capitalism reproduces itself. And every way that capitalism reproduces itself is a thing that should be attacked. Then later they say, also,
culture... Okay, wait, I'm very confused by that statement, but okay, yeah, onward.
Also, culture is like air. You can't stop breathing it. The time the idealized anarch hero spends between burning down a bank and assassinating a cop is spent swimming in cultural hegemony. Gross. Capitalism pollutes every moment of our existence. Every moment of our existence. If we have to breathe this shit, we might as well exhale our disgust and attempt to pollute it back, right? Is capitalism this omnipresent? If we...
on the one hand, I think that's nonsense. It's sort of a grab bag of big words that mean bad. And, you know, pointing at Hollywood. So, okay, fair enough. Hollywood is bad. I think we can all agree. And the other thing I'll say is that Ben Turk, the primary person who you've been dialoguing with and the primary person behind this project, is also the primary person behind this project called the Insurgent Theater. Mm-hmm. That I never actually saw one of their plays, but there were a couple that actually, at least one made it to the Bastard, and one or two has made it to the Bay Area over years. And my take is that project does extremely sincere, like, does sincere plays about intense topics and makes audiences uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I don't go and see intense films. Mm-hmm. I don't like, in other words, there's a whole vocabulary here that I know, like, they're talking about media and you know, creative media as if it's important, and I'm just not on board. And all the nonsense about reification, all the rest, that's sort of a separate set of points. But I just don't accept the premise
that creative media are important to anarchists.
Yeah,
that's a very provocative thing to say. Do you want to flesh that out at all?
Well, I mean, mostly, of course, it's like anything can be of interest to anarchists. I mean, so I don't want to say it like in that sort of a term, but I'm not sure how politically they're important for anarchists. Mm-hmm. Like, you can do some politics on top of it, but it's a static thing. It is this, you know, monstrosity of economic engine in the Hollywood machine and all the rest. And you know, as I don't have any interest in that particular machine, I'm just not going to engage in those politics. But it's but I think that what they're saying is that they, as creative people, are personally offended by the aggression of Hollywood. And when you put it that way, it sort of both minimizes it, but it also sort of, like, it makes sense that if you consider yourself a playwright or mm-hmm. a movie maker, and then you go and see, what have they done so far, Mad Max.
Mad Max, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and there's the third one.
You go back and you see silly Hollywood. I can imagine a type of personality who says to themselves, I could do that better, and it offends my politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's easy to call it leftist, but they need something else in addition to all of that to make this interesting to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that is.
Yeah, and just the last thing I want to say about it is, I don't know what world they're inhabiting, but I don't feel that capitalism is polluting every moment of my existence. It's very similar to the Peter Lamborn Wilson thing we talked about mm-hmm. in the first episode, where you're saying the world outside civilization is alive, whereas inside it's dead. And you said, I don't want to say civilization's quite that powerful. Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel. If capitalism consists largely of these reified behaviors, reified social roles and thoughts, then sure, it's there a lot of the time, but isn't there a disillusion of it when in the space and time that radical acts are happening? And doesn't that mean it's this thing that sort of comes and goes moment to moment, depending on what is going on in your life? And I mean, I don't experience after a passionate intercourse with a lover, then the thing saying, I'm not saying to myself, hey, that was great, except for the fact that capitalism was polluting every single moment.
Every orifice.
So.
Yeah, I don't want to sort of just use insulting terms to describe this project, but
no,
but it does seem like it needs sort of one more thing to make it pop into the arena of what I would call interesting. Okay, next up we're going to talk about Free Radical Radio.
So, given that this is the end of our sort of four-episode series of pre-launching this, it occurred to me that I should say something about Free Radical Radio, because my co-host just the other day put something on our website saying I'm not going to be there, and I just wanted to speak to that to say that I had a wonderful time doing that project, and there were many exciting aspects of it to me, and it definitely pushed me to think more seriously about my ideas. And when I was younger and more bright-eyed, and we started that project, it was very stimulating to me, and I felt that I had a lot of chemistry with the people I was doing it with, and that my co-host Ryder, once when we were interviewed on Final Straw Radio by Bursts, he described the show as consisting primarily of our relationship, and that relationship has changed over the years to the point that this is not something I want to do with this person right now, and so we're going off and doing different things.
Well, congratulations to have a clear ending. Mm-hmm. A lot of times projects like that can fade over an even longer time than this one did.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's part of it too. I didn't want it to turn into something that was an obligation that I felt I had to keep doing. And so when it started to feel like something that I was self-coercing rather than being excited about it, I stopped doing it.
Yeah, and I guess we'll wrap this section out with talking about recent drama that I've been involved in, which unsurprisingly involves Bob Black.
Used to be my homie, used to be my ace. Now I want to slap the taste out your mouth. Make it bow down to the rope. Fucking me, now I'm fucking you, little hoe. Oh, don't think I forgot. Let you slide, let me ride. Just another homicide. Yeah, it's me, so I'ma talk on. Stomping on the easiest streets that you can walk.
For those of you who don't know the history between me and Bob Black, I've been on friendly terms with him for probably about a decade. And then over the past 3 years, we at Little Black Cart have published two different of his books. The most recent being Instead of Work. And about 2 years ago, we published a book called Defacing the Currency. And so in that time, I've definitely developed a relationship with Bob that has been friendly, a little intense, and at enough distance that I felt comfortable in it. So we recently invited Bob over here to the Bay and had an event with him. He was traveling internationally and passed through San Francisco on his way to other places. So in that time, we read a famous piece by Bob, The Abolition of Work, in the Anarchist Study Group. This was on a Tuesday. I had lunch with Bob on a Thursday, and during that lunch, during the reading group on Tuesday, we had a local activist person named Morgan come to the reading group and basically attempt to commandeer the reading group with the discussion of whether or not it's appropriate for anarchists to talk about a snitch and sort of beg us to, instead of talking about the piece itself, talk about Bob as snitch. And when we refused to do that, Morgan picked up the backpack and left the study group. So when I saw Bob on Thursday, we had lunch, I said, Bob, this thing happened on Tuesday with Morgan. This was the extent of it. And I anticipate that this person will probably come tomorrow and shout a little bit. Probably they'll come up with a snappy chant or two, and that will be the extent of the interaction. So come Friday, this is August 7th, the event began early, about 7 p.m., and with the anticipation being that Bob would start talking 7:45-ish. Around 7:30, Morgan walked in the door with backpack and heavy makeup on, and they walked to the back and immediately started shouting at Bob, basically nothing more coherent than snitch, snitch, snitch. And in that interaction, Bob responded to Morgan by saying, your mascara is smeared. And after Bob said that, Morgan punched Bob in the face 3 times. Morgan was then carried out of the venue and put on the sidewalk. The door was locked. And largely the event, like the altercation or the sort of instigating event to what I'm going to talk about later, was over. The event went swimmingly. Bob spoke for about an hour. He had Q&A for another half hour to an hour. And then we sat and had drinks and enjoyed each other's company for another hour or two. So in other words, this little intervention at the early part of the evening not only didn't succeed, but a good time was had by all. And while obviously people sort of were buzzing about Morgan's intervention, primarily no one saw the intervention as having a deeper significance or being much of anything. Bob leaves the scene for about a month, traveling. When he returns, his first sort of speaking of the event that happened was basically to denounce me for being a traitor. And so he not only accused me of being a traitor, but also declared that I was his enemy and attempted to blow my pseudonym, which he did incorrectly. So I mention all this because at this point, as many people know, Bob believes in this political practice of revenge. And so within the context of Facebook, Bob has been on a sort of political vendetta against me, of which blowing my pseudonym appears to be the worst of it so far. But I imagine an essay is forthcoming of my problems. Probably the most relevant thing that will come out of it from my perspective is as a publisher of his books, he's already asked me to destroy all copies of the book, which we will not do. And I'm sure some surprises are forthcoming. I'm not sure what else to say about this other than, yeah. Oh, I did just write a blog entry about this on my blog at ericwarren.anarchyplanet.org. And I'm sure that there'll be more murmurings of this, but for people who wanted all the sort of details, I believe I've given as many as I can remember. Is there anything?
Yeah, mostly I just think of, I think it was the last episode we were talking about how part of the urban context and modern relationships is that when there's conflict, the tendencies for it to pretty quickly go to, I don't want anything to do with you anymore. And it's just unfortunate to see.
Yeah. I mean,
rather than, you know, a good faith effort to work things out.
Yeah. I mean, the problem for me, of course, is I'm not exactly sure what there is to work out. I didn't punch him and, you know, invite the puncher. And a lot of the accusations right now are about Bob's suspicion that it was somehow in cahoots with Morgan.
Right, which just seems absurd.
Yeah, it's absurd, it's unsubstantiated, and it is not true. Yeah, but, yeah. But you know, I wish Bob well, and I think that this is a sad ending to a relationship and a collaboration, but perhaps it's the only way in which it was possible to end it.
Let's start off with a definition from Wolfie, and then later we'll talk about Jason McQuinn's understanding of critical theory, and then we'll get to the Ottentot piece. And the idea here is to compare and contrast these and talk about what critical theory is, what it should look like, what it means to apply it, and is it this sort of pure anarchist practice, or is it can it take on a kind of sacred cow status in its own right? And so I'll start off with Wolfie's definition from the essay. He says, quote, critical thinking is the practice of examining a situation or an argument, assessing its strengths and weaknesses in order to be able to grasp it and turn it to one's own ends. This involves the capacity for recognizing fallacious reasoning and methods of manipulating language, facts, and emotions, end quote. So I think immediately you get the kind of insurrectionary resonance there, where it's always about this kind of moment-to-moment analysis. What can you do in each situation? And it's not surprising coming from Wolfie. I think this has a maybe a more embodied resonance to it than a lot of definitions of critical theory, because he's implies that it has immediate practical application. One thing I want to talk about more when we get to Jason's thing is this kind of dichotomy between theory and practice. I would say Wolfie's does a good job of dissolving that dichotomy. And I'm very much inclined to agree with basically every word here. Anyone who listens to Free Radical Radio knows that I, for a while there, I was getting kind of repetitive and preachy with this this idea of emphasizing the importance of critical theory, the importance of propagating it, and basically saying that there's clearly no shortage of people who are in some way or another dissatisfied with the status quo, and that what I was seeing as the problem was that that kind of dissatisfaction was either not applied or applied in a useless way. And I think a lot of times things are not applied because people have this vague idea that everything is wrong in some fundamental way, but they don't know what it is. It's very easy to internalize that and say it must be something's wrong with me. Or you have the other outcome, which is that energy being jettisoned into this kind of useless, easily recuperable activity, becoming part of the loyal resistance or the reform effort. And so what I was saying again and again on Free Radical Radio was what we would need for things to change would be a propagation of critical theory.
So just to speak to
And you, I'm being self-critical here, so yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you're just saying that you were repetitive. You're not actually being critical of the content of what you're talking about. I guess for me, anytime I hear someone sort of speak to a big word or a big phrase like critical thinking, I try to understand the content, what it is that they're saying. And obviously, like, there are sort of longer and more boring definitions of critical thinking. But the other thing I try to do is I try to understand what that terminology means within the context in which it lives. So there's two contexts that I think are important. And this is sort of the Frankfurt School,
right,
on the one hand,
yep,
and sort of the Western philosophical tradition and how, mm-hmm, the Frankfurt School completed to a great extent that tradition before, mm-hmm, postmodernism and post-structuralism. And then the second part is, what does criticism, the expression of critical thinking, look like on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
And more I have felt as though the terminology as you use it has felt like a very rational way to understand sort of positionality and ideas. And so I've had a sort of visceral resistance to that aspect, to the sort of utter clarity and reasonability of series of positions and, mm-hmm, and articulations of you know, formations and disagreements and, mm-hmm, and all the rest. And on the other hand, I've really wanted to disobey this Western tradition, as seen like in the Frankfurt School. And I'm not sure how to do that, like how to sort of break out of proper debate mechanisms or whatever, mm-hmm, to talk about, like, you know, whatever. Staring at a bird flying across the sky is never a critical thinking activity.
Yeah.
But it's pretty important, mm-hmm, to my perspective. And I don't want to be robotic about what the difference is between a bird across the sky and why I hate the left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a way to ground what I'm saying is that I think... So I used to be a bartender, and I would spend a lot of time... And it was a dive bar, and I would spend a lot of time with these regulars who would come in and complain about their lives, right? But the common thread across these complaints, I think, was this idea of, more or less explicitly stated, of, yeah, the world is fucked, but it also is inevitable that it is the way it is, or there's something perfectly natural about the way that it is, and, you know, I got the short end of the stick, but someone had to. And so when I say that the problem is not that most people are okay with things and anarchists are just this weird minority who hates it, but rather that the people who dislike it see it as inevitable or fixed. And so when I talk about having more people having a critical analysis, I mean more people recognizing that things are the way they are because of a lot of human activity that could be oriented in a different direction.
I've seen very little evidence that strong arguments convince people to change their minds. Mm-hmm. More often, what I see convince people to change their minds are they going to get laid if they change their mind? Are the cool kids or the people they perceive to be the cool kids doing this other thing? In other words, these unrational things that speak to the baser instincts of humans tend to be persuasive. The kind of person that is persuaded by the best argument, by the best logic, by reason, tends to be of a type. And I don't just want to speak to unfairly to that type just because of they're demographically middle class and male and Caucasian and all the rest. But I do want to speak to the fact that the same thinking that is convinced by reason tends to also be convinced about a whole set of other things that I do experience in my daily life. So at work, I experience a lot of people who are utterly reasonable and who are persuaded by rational arguments. These are the kind of people who you hand the anarchist FAQ to, and they come back to you 2 months later and they say, I have processed the information, and I agree with many of the premises, and I would like to continue this conversation more. So this is, again, where critical thinking in and of itself falls apart for me.
So I expected you to take it more or less in this direction, and what I was going to say was, you know, this was... for me, and I mean, the reason I was sort of making fun of myself was I just started doing that project. I was really excited to talk about the issues, right? And I recognize now that there was a kind of evangelistic bend to that, that maybe involved this kind of weird, particular perception of what human nature was, and that, you know, the human, like a Homo sapiens in the proper sense, that can be appealed to with reason. And,
if only I could meet the rational man.
If only I could sit down with the man.
Exactly. Sure. Like Ronald Reagan's famous thing. If you could just sit down with the Russians, they could hash this whole Cold War thing out.
So I want to then take that into what Wolfie says here a little bit later. He says a major part of an anarchist strategy is to undermine people's belief in the legitimacy of the state. So very much what I was just saying, and we just need to talk about it. And if we are then taking this stand of saying, well, maybe people are really motivated by rutting and what have you, then, or like monkey acceptance, then how does this align with doing media projects?
Yeah.
You've done a lot of media projects, thrown all these books out there. If they're not for the rational man, then...
Well, I'm not quite sure that fits. I think that the critical ding works. I think that's fair. Uh-huh. Like you can't actually divorce media projects from some sort of sense of attempting to persuade.
Sure.
On the other hand, if you were going to evaluate my particular media project, it could be safely declared to be a bit incoherent in terms of what we're trying to convince people to do.
Sure, sure.
And of course, one of the things that, you know, if I were to be immediately flip about it, I would say that one of the things we're trying to accomplish is human capacity to be critical thinkers.
Sure.
So the ding is appropriate. I guess the safe post-lefty type answer is that I'm ultimately trying to speak to an audience that doesn't know that it exists, or it does. And so, for better or for worse, Little Black Cart as a target audience is speaking to a very small set of people. We're not like we've yet be ambitious enough to attempt to speak to all college students, or we basically assume that that our potential reader is part or used to be part of the anarchist milieu. And so that's the other way to answer your question is to say, I'm not a very good propagandist. I require the spark to already have been set, and I'm just willing to add fuel to it.
Yeah.
And, but partially this is because I work with a lot of people, and most of those people are utterly uninterested in persuasion. I am more interested in persuasion than most of those people, and so I'm much more the target of that particular ding. than the rest of LBC is.
So I want to jump to Jason's definition, and then we can talk about some critique of critique. So Jason's definition in his piece, it's actually in the same extended Wolfie piece. An Introduction to Critical Theory. That's the one. Okay, so he writes, "The resolution to the dilemma posed by the split which accompanies all instances of positive theory is the dialectical path toward unitary thought, critical theory. Critical theory attempts to restore the alienated, isolated individual to a position as a real social subject in the life of the world. It maintains a constant awareness of its own relation to its origins in individual subjectivity and to the object it wishes to comprehend." And then he quotes a piece called Self Theory, saying, "The critical theorist, quote, goes through a reversal of his perspective on his life and the world. Nothing is true for him but his desires, his will to be. He refuses all ideology in his hatred for the miserable social relations in modern capitalist global society. From this reverse perspective, it is easy to see with a newly acquired clarity the upside-down world of reification, the thingification of aspects of daily life, the inversion of subject and object, of abstract and concrete. It is the theatrical landscape of fetishized commodities, mental projections, separations, and ideologies. Art, God, city planning, common sense, ethics, smile buttons, radio stations that say they love you, and detergents that have compassion for your hands." I'm seeing some body language here.
The one thing I will say, so this wasn't written as Jason, it was written as Lev, which was the pen name he used in the pretty early days. I think he stopped using Lev at least by 2000.
Yeah.
If not by the 90s. So, in this piece I just wrote today about Bob and really about his generation, which Jason and Bob are about the same age, I speak to this aspect of Anarchy, A Journal of Desire Arm that I really liked, which was basically how much they were like an American version of the SI, and they were grappling with the same problems that the SI was grappling with in France 10 and 20 years prior, but from an American perspective. So that was the thing I really appreciated about Ajota, and it's worthwhile to mention that, like, I continue to appreciate that about Ajota, and I find myself much more in the SI and in what the SI project was, then I find myself in the Stirnerite project that Lev was much more Stirnerite, and obviously here he's attempting a dialectics that sort of lives within the Marxist canon that the SI also lived in. So I find myself much more sort of in this vocabulary than I do in the more recent vocabulary of ponderings of the self and a rereading, a modern rereading of Stirner. But that said, I'm personally opposed to this sort of dialectical gamesmanship and don't find that part that you read interesting at all.
Yeah, so the way this actually comes up, some earlier conversations you and I were having where you were saying you're very against this idea of dialectic, and I mean, I think the way that you tend to understand it is there's an objectively dialectic as their the specific understanding, I should say, of a revolutionary subject that interacts with the world and then carries it over to the next historical stage, whereas he seems to understand dialectics mostly as dissolving dichotomies or being anti-dualistic or showing how both sides of a dualism actually inform each other.
Six minutes of conversation lost.
It's not exactly critical engagement.
No.
It's something else. Mm-hmm. And when Dominique speaks to himself being a reader, what he's speaking about is the fact that he is open when he, you know, receives a text, he is open to that text touching him in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. I like the feel of that, the texture of that. And it isn't as grandiose as critical thinking. And so I think that actually speaks a little bit to a different moment that we're in today than the moment that they were in the 80s and 90s when they wrote these pieces. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that we're in a moment of grand ideas. Mm-hmm. I think that we're probably in a moment where the internet has exposed all of us to so many fucking grand ideas that we need some space to figure out some ideas on our own. Mm-hmm. And that's what a reader is.
Okay. So that's in a way you elided the question of of what critical theory is, unless you're saying it is that kind of openness to experience. I mean, in a lot of ways that sounds like uncritical, right? You're accepting rather than criticizing. You're chewing on something rather than just immediately trying to attack it. But maybe that speaks to a problem with our whole orientation, where I think the anarchist affect is often, I'm in a hostile relationship with the world, therefore I'm more likely to reject, attack, dissect than I am to accept or unify. Or
well, I have to admit, I am of two minds here, because I, on the one hand, I really do look for people to make excellent recommendations to me. Mm. And because I'm generally not able to truly criticize something until I've worked through it once, just to masticate it, a second time to sort of see if there are any good bits in it that actually relate directly to my experience. Mm-hmm. And then later in the process, I'm able to sort of speak to it in a larger sense that would look like criticism. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that's extremely challenging for readers is when the weight of critical thinking has already sort of forsaken whatever interpretation you're going to get out of a book, I think that makes reading almost impossible. Like, I think about a lot of the famous post-structuralist books I read when I was living alone in a van. And I was in a reading group at the time, and it was very small, and it was mostly about anarchist texts. So I was reading this post-structuralist stuff alone. And as a result, I got weird ideas out of the books that were not probably correct. Mm-hmm. But the argument I only was able to get because I was reading rather than critically engaging. In other words, I wasn't just like, when I hear, especially graduate students talk about, you read one of the books in a week or whatever, and how hard it is they do. And, you know, you realize that the only reason that they're reading it is to sort of lock it into the place of a template, a pre-thought out critical thinking template, mm-hmm. that it fits into. Ah, patriarchy. Ah, xenophobia. You know? Yeah. And I feel sorry for that relationship to text.
Mm. So another critique of critical theory that occurred to me as I was reading this was the one from the Invisible Committee, which I read to our friends very recently, so it's very much on my mind. And maybe we could do a review of that piece at some point, because and I had this kind of immediate rankling response when early in the piece, where they're sort of laying out what they see as the crisis, the social crisis, and they say what is needed is not, and they have a whole list of things that they say are not important, are not going to push us toward communism or what have you. And one of them is, they say we do not need the dissemination of critical theory. Mm. And they contrast that with what is instead needed is a common perception. And so the post-left in me just immediately goes, oh, you're for ideology, you're not for individuals thinking critically for themselves. And it's actually something that I don't even know what to do with in that book, especially because they coupled that statement with these references to our party, and they're sort of taking that back from Marx in a way, because they are critical of Marx, but they're using his our party, and they make references like that a few times. And so when you couple our party with shared perception, to me it starts to get weird.
Yeah.
And especially when you're saying we don't need critical theory.
Well, again, I mean, I'm not going to defend Tikkun's take, because my take isn't that we shouldn't read these things and we shouldn't engage in critical theory. I absolutely have and would recommend that anyone do the same. Where I'm going is more that I'm not sure that critical thinking or theory are the end-all and be-all that I thought that they were 20 years ago.
Sure.
You know, I got here through books, and after I read a bunch of books, I then found people. And I think a lot of people have a similar experience, although they would replace the word books with the word internet. And But it means that to arrive here prepared for the new relationships that I developed, I had a bunch of experiential. I had a bunch of knowledge ahead of time. And how Takun come off is that they did the hard thinking, took a big weight off of our shoulders, and now we can come and join the party. Oh, boy, isn't that great?
Yeah.
I mean, the actual, in Europe, right, they're not called Takunists. They're called Appellistas.
What does that mean?
The Appell was the document that we call Call.
Okay.
And so their baseline of so the reason they're called the Appellistas is because basically to sort of be on board with their program, you're supposed to read, understand, and agree with Call.
Okay.
And so that's their baseline of political understanding.
Okay.
And
yeah, this is getting stranger the more you explain it to me. Because now there's the book.
It's a pamphlet. It's very small.
Okay, but...
But yeah, right, text. Right. No, yeah. I mean, they're called the Appellistas. They're people of the word, and their word is called is Call.
Yeah.
And so in that way, like, Call is one of the, is probably the most readable of everything they've ever done.
Okay.
And so again, the people with the masters and PhDs in social sciences did this hard work to make these texts that then the Appellistas can read and sign on the dotted line or not. And so all of this has this hallmark of a politic that sort of we both can't accept because we're Americans, because it sounds crazy.
Yeah.
And we can't accept because it's very French, you know, it's just so French. And finally, because politically as anarchists, we just don't accept the idea that we're going to let other people do the thinking for us.
Yeah. The division of labor must be a good thing. Your cells do it. So.
Yeah, exactly.
They're the brain cells.
Yeah, I mean, so where I'm going more is to say that I think the critical thinking has shown us its limits, and we should understand what those limits are.
Yeah, and so I mean, Wolfie brings up, of course, the Stirner criticism that critique can almost take on this own fixed idea status in your life, where you become obsessed with it. And I think we see that with people who want to have the totalizing theory that explains everything that's wrong with society, lays out the program, here's what's going on. I mean, I think that would be the reification of critical theory. And I want to, since we are getting a little short on time, move into the Attentat piece that is called A Critique of Critique. And not sure exactly how you want to go with this. I had a few comments on different parts.
Sure.
Yeah. So part three talks about the tradition of critique and the sort of academizing of it. I'm going to read a little passage of it. In this tradition, each new generation treats as an important part of its coming of age, not only their allegedly full comprehension of the past, of the context, knowledge, and mistakes of past generations, but a kind of destruction of what came before. Not that it really destroys the past, or is it even intended to really. The idea that domain mastery includes an appraisal and negotiation of the domain itself is tied into most fields of knowledge. And so to me, this speaks of really deep pessimism about the possibilities of critical theory. And I couldn't help but be reminded of Nietzsche in On the Genealogy of Morality, where he's talking about history and understandings of history, and how it's a kind of myth-making, even as he's creating his own sort of myth. And he relates interpretation of the past to a will to power, in that critique or examination of the past becomes this sort of continual reinterpretation of the past for an ostensibly important or superior or more rebellious present. And so there's this sort of impossibility of a knowledge of the past as such, except insofar as it serves whatever present interests. Mm-hmm. That's how I read that going. I don't know if you have a comment on it. Maybe a pessimism for critique's capacity for truth.
Yeah, I guess what I hear that as being is sort of the problem of Young Turks. I guess that's on the next line. I'm trying to think of a sort of fresh insight about this, and it's just not coming to me. So move on to your next comment. Yeah,
sure. Part four talks about the academy as this kind of expropriator of mental labor, and academy maybe could be seen as the unfortunate realization of the theory practice dichotomy, where theory really does just become disconnected from mm-hmm. life activity for the professional critic, as the Ottentot piece puts it. And you're known for being very critical of the academy and anarchists going mm-hmm. to the academy. I've heard that practice often defended as, well, hey, I am going in there to do the hard work and fight that field of the battle, and it's just another one as good as any other. And I'm wondering if you want to touch on that, or do you see the academy as necessarily a dead end? Or
I want to start out by saying that I spent my early years being vicious towards the people around me who were making the decisions to go into the academy.
Sure.
And by being vicious, I ended my relationship with many people. And so in hindsight, someone who maybe were a bit more interested in growing old with people around me, I perhaps would have made different decisions. And so I would like to say for the record that just because you go to grad school doesn't mean that you stop being my friend forever. But I will say that I've never seen anyone have anything like the kind of success that statement alludes to. Mm-hmm. That the people who I've known who have been the most successful in the context of the academy have become the most mediocre in terms of where their political conclusions have taken them and all the rest.
Yeah.
The actual harder response that I've gotten from academics, because at some point, a critique of the academy basically says that, like, some jobs are better than other jobs.
Right.
But the reason why some jobs are better than other jobs is some jobs actually pay you for your time and energy. And the academy is not, nowadays, one of those positions. So to follow up on my example, there was a very smart person who we would loosely call an anti-state communist who went and got their PhD studying Heidegger. So continental philosophy in the U.S., Heidegger of all people. And I basically sort of had this discussion with them where I ended up landing somewhere near the position of saying that you might not think that what you're doing is useful to the man, but you don't know what's useful and what isn't. And more importantly, you just sitting in your little hamster wheel doing that work is in and of itself useful for the man. Mm-hmm. And they're basically,
because your time is being sucked in.
Yeah. Well, and you know, like, if you do stupid work, you become stupid. Mm-hmm. And their response, which was perfectly reasonable, was to say over and over again, no one is ever going to read my stupid shit on Heidegger. Mm-hmm. So that means that they're basically their life work is to get paid not a great wage to write stupid shit about Heidegger. And now, like every other person we know, right, they ended up not being a particularly good academic. They didn't play the game in such a way that lands you a job. And now they're just chasing jobs around the country on partial gigs after partial gigs. And I believe that they landed on a good one in that they have a tenure track position in the community college. That kind of position nets you like 45 grand a year. They probably have 150 grand in debt mm-hmm. to get a 45 grand a year job, which literally, you know, right now they could be driving Uber and make that kind of money.
And have more free time to write things.
And have a lot more free time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're basically, to put my Marx hat on for a second, there are a series of mythological class constructions at the heart of what convinces someone to go to grad school.
Prestige, yeah.
Yeah, the prestige of it, the idea of jobs with prestige. Yeah. Like,
you can say, look, Mom, I did it.
Well, and not only that, like who doesn't want a life filled with co-eds and tenure and, you know, smoke-filled rooms with, like, nice wood furnishings? I mean, all that seems wonderful.
You're going back to the brick
buildings.
Trying to get laid.
Sure.
Trying to get the Schopenhauer, like, all human activity is actually about getting laid.
And I perhaps agree with that more than I should, but not me. But I've just seen other people do it. And so for me, the weakness of that life decision is how it basically completes a whole bunch of life decisions that you could be making for their own sake mm-hmm. and sacrifice them to an institution that gladly accepts them.
Sure. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was part five, because it really struck me, where it is written, "The myth that between here and tomorrow is the hard work of people like you and me, of our progressive mission and new and improved ideas, is a trap. It keeps us into serving those who profit from all this work. It traps us into believing in the work itself. It traps us in a bind of others' designs." So again, I see a kind of deep pessimism about the possibilities of theory. We often, I think of theory as getting better. Certainly when I was getting into these ideas, I thought of anti-civ theory as being a big improvement, a progression over anarchist theory that valorized the worker, valorized industry. I think a post-left critique of anti-oppression excesses to be an improvement. I think of egoism as an improvement over anarchist calls for justice, equality, and morality. But the provocation here is that is a kind of trap. And so if theory does not really progress, what does it mean to say that you're developing anarchist critique or you're engaging with the ideas? And is the critique, or is the relationship between critique and civilization or domination, rather than being one of critique is getting better and better, more akin to that between parasite and host, where both are changing, responding to each other, one's becoming more immune, one's becoming more virulent, but neither is really going anywhere in this objective, long, linear way?
Well, the first thing I would say is, he doesn't exactly speak to me, but there's this cat who does French translation, mostly of the early 19th century, named Sean Wilber. And Sean is deeply connected to this idea that almost no new idea is a new idea at all.
Yeah, there's that classical Greek who said that. Yeah, nothing is new under the sun.
So. Right, yeah. Right. And you know, obviously, like, I can't even parse elegantly through the English translations that I'm sure Sean is doing a total workman's job on. I can't even exactly parse through that to get to the, to where I see it. But I it sounds plausible to me that this idea that many of the what's definitely clear and what I have gotten out of his writing is that the controversies and the fights and the disagreements that they had then are very, very similar to the ones we're having today.
Sure.
And so I'm not sure I read this as being as pessimistic as you say.
Okay.
I feel like I'm, that said, not that I agree with the progressive, that our ideas are getting better, mm-hmm. but that the closer you get to participating in these conversations, the different, like, in other words, when you're going to be engaged in these conversations, you're going to write the article that then gets responded to by a comrade who you disagree with only in these little ways. That's the major change that I feel that people have. Mm-hmm. In other words, the time when you publish an essay under your name and people who know you give you feedback, there's something there that does feel very different than the trap.
Sure.
But that's because I guess perhaps for me, anarchist theory, I feel resembles a lot more like DIY hardcore music than it does things that happen in the academy. Mm-hmm. We're writing small little things for each other in the hope that we engage in these different ways. Like, so for instance, for me, the fact that we don't necessarily agree on everything, but we're in conversation about this and it doesn't feel like a debate, mm-hmm. that feels to me like what the good work is.
Yeah, sure.
To the extent to which there is a good work. Whereas there's something in here, in this thing that you just quoted, that feels like how people talk about their work as if their work were important, capital I, work, capital W. And the, you know, there's a sort of trademarked feel to it that I feel like is just a really different orientation than the one that I would take. And perhaps people who are concerned about their brand names, whether it's nihilism or civilization or whatever, that this is probably the trap.